We vibe check the streaky Dallas Mavericks. We go through the candidates for most improved player and talk about how the future of the Atlanta Hawks might be Jalen Johnson. That and more coming up right now on this episode of No Cap Room. Hello, friends. Welcome to No Cap Room. My name is Jake Fisher, senior NBA reporter at Yahoo Sports. Joining me as always, senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports. It's my man. It's your man. It's everyone's man. It's Dan Devine. What's up, buddy?
Jake, I'm so thrilled to be with you. You're in a hotel room. I'm in my cave here with all the wood window, the curtains drawn. The vibes are weird, but they're good. I'm feeling excited to talk about NBA basketball with you. Let's fucking go.
I'm here. The NC Armada. We are about to set sail from Miami, where I watched the Heat. That was my impression of the arena announcer.
Okay, I thought you just said it like that. That's a way. I'm like, I'd never heard you say that way. That was very surprising to me.
The Miami Heat. How was that?
That was great. That was really good. It's an energy I didn't expect, and I'm delighted by it.
Thank you. I've never been to a Heat game since as a media member. I went as a child with my father during a Sixers Heat playoff game. I think that was 2011, I want to say. So it was a nice time checking out the Casillas Center.
Yeah, I was down there I got scrambled a little bit for Celtics Heat last in the conference finals, and then was there during the finals. And it was like humidity, not my biggest. No, I'm not great at humidity. We talked about this with Wes Goldberg when we talked about the Heat on Divine Intervention, and he was trying to argue for the positives of it. I was not having it. That in June, even more so. But the as a place to watch a game, though, not too bad.
Not too bad. A lot of air conditioning, but it's okay. We got through it, and we're going to get through this podcast episode, even though the Wi-Fi situation is not ideal. But the situation isn't ideal for everyone around the league right now, as we've touched on many an injury woe. However, there are some positive turns. Donovan Mitchell, he came back last night, and the Cavs beat the Pelicans, where Joe Garza, our editor, was on hand. They beat the Pelicans by 21 points in New Orleans without Evan Mobley, Max Strus, and the cult hero, Dean Wade. Dan, the Cavs reclaimed the 2 seed last night. Are you buying or selling them as a formidable threat to the Boston Celtics in the Eastern Conference?
I mean, at this point, everybody is kind of like, if you're trying to see the Celtics, you need to squint and you need binoculars. But the Cavs have been awesome for 3 months now, basically, since mid-December. In whatever iterations they've had, whoever's been in and out, they've been able to make it work. So I think they are now up to, I think, like a 40% odds from unpredictable.com of securing the number 2 seed, even more bullish in some other places. You know, like Basketball Reference has them up by like 70% to land at number 2. They're pretty comfortably in that spot. Getting Mitchell back is gigantic. The offense can function well when Darius Garland is aggressive and making threes, but it functions clearly at its best when Mitchell is in there. Made 4 threes last night, even on an off night for him, on sort of limited minutes. It boosts everybody. So the Cavs can be dangerous when they've got their guys hitting shots and Mitchell's able to get downhill and create. And that's certainly what we saw against the Pelicans. Sorry, Joe. Sorry that you had to watch your beloved New Orleans Pelicans get mollywopped like that.
Yeah. No, the North Star of Boston in the East has been like the obvious backdrop for all the playoff talk. Cause even like our next news item being that the Magic gave Jamal Mosley a 4-year contract extension. Well deserved Jamal Mosley. You took Rick Carlisle flaming your chances in Dallas as he walked out the door and you made lemonade out of lemons. Jokes aside, truly a really incredible rebuild turnaround that the Magic have going, and a team that like gave Boston problems in the play-in tournament. I'm here you know, I watched the Heat fumble again, a late lead to Denver, and like the vibes around the Casilla Center are not great, man. Like a lot of angst, a lot of exasperation from friends of the show like Wes Goldberg that you shouted out, and the other members of the Heat beat, and people around the organization just like, oh man, we've lost four straight now. We're the only team that's lost seven straight and won seven straight. But like, if we get Boston, if we get anyone but Boston in the first round, like we think we'll be right. Okay. Like that is clearly the North Star of all of this, which I think is very interesting, I guess.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is the measuring stick everybody's got to sort of put themselves up against. But in terms of the Magic, you know, you mentioned Jamal Mosley like making lemons out of lemonade with the coaching situation. He's also made a good defense, a borderline great defense out of young guys, which almost never happens. You know, the kind of the rule in the NBA is if you get a young roster, it's going to take some lumps to get them on, you know, the same page on the defensive end and up to speed. He took over a team that was 24th in defensive efficiency the season before he got there. And then since, it's just a steady upward trajectory, 17th, 11th last year, and now this year, fourth. And that has been consistent from basically once they had that really rocky start to last season and then played above 500 ball over the last, I want to say like 57, 58 games. And they have just kept steadily climbing and building. And some of that is, you know, individual pieces. You know, Jalen Suggs, you know, is going to get all defensive consideration. Jonathan Isaac, when he's on the floor, is an absolute menace. And they just got size, you know, with, you know, they can play Paolo Banchero, they can play Franz Wagner, Goga Bitadze, Wendell Carter Jr., all the bigs that they've got. And even their guards are big. And like Cole Anthony goes to the defensive glass like a demon. Like they've got size kind of everywhere and length kind of everywhere. It's the way that Magic teams have been built for years. But still like, getting the buy-in, getting those guys to commit and realize you came in here as a highly draft, like high draft pick, highly touted guy. The way you play and the way we win is you defend. Not an easy thing to do. And so for him to get that buy-in, to get them up to where like they've got a real shot at home court advantage in the first round of the playoffs, which is, I think, if you told any Magic fan or any Magic observer before the season, that's where you can realistically expect to be. I don't know that they would have bought it, but this is already the best season they've had since Dwight Howard was gone. And it's got a chance to be the first, put them in position to maybe win their first playoff series and even longer than that. So tremendous job, tremendous for Jamal Mosley and that staff. It took him 15 years as an assistant to get this gig. And he is absolutely grabbing it with both hands, making the most out of it, and maybe even making a run of coach of the year.
I have a GIF flashing in my head of Will Ferrell, long curly Jufro, Flint, Michigan Tropics jersey, fourth place, because it would be momentous. It really would. One last news item here. Otto Porter Jr. retiring after 11 NBA seasons with six different teams. Just a weird career, honestly, for someone who was a top three pick, who I remember back when I was in college picking his Georgetown Hoyas to win the title that year, and they lost in the first round. And then he ends up getting a $100 million contract and the injury stuff. But won a title with the Warriors, man. I remember being in TD Garden for game three. That, like, man, really decisive series of switching game. It was game four. Game four is when they came back from 2-2. And the switch definitely flipped. And he was just like everything that you would have thought Otto Porter at that point of his career would have been. And he got another contract out of it in Toronto before he got traded back to Utah, where the road has ended. So just shout out Otto Porter Jr. I mean, 11 years is nothing to sniff at. The title, congrats to a Hoya legend, even though he wasn't able to make right on a lot of brackets that were busted.
Yeah, I mean, my memory that I'll always associate with him, it'll shock you to learn that when there was reporting about him signing an offer sheet, I want to say with the Kings, that when he got that big nine-figure deal, I wound up writing. I wrote way too much about it. You know, shocking. I wrote way too many words about it. But where it was that argument of like, this is the kind of player who will matter for where the league is going, where you can have that, you know, 6'8", 6'9", switchable wing who can defend, who can hit spot up threes, who can rebound, scale up to play power forward. like this is like if I remember right, the thrust of the argument was like the kind of guy Otto Porter has shown he can be in spurts is the kind of guy who can matter on a big stage. And then obviously a lot of injuries and issues in Washington led to that not really being the case. He goes to Chicago. Everyone who has gone to Chicago for the past, you know, handful of years has kind of just wound up in some kind of Bermuda Triangle vortex there. But winds his way to Golden State. And yeah, like another veteran rehabbed in that system who just like knew how to play and could do the job specifically that they needed. It's hard to find guys that fit what the Warriors do. He was one of them. And more than a decade in the NBA, it's like double the average career length, I think. So, you know, you a race well run and, you know, plenty of money in the bank and a ring in the trophy case. Can't beat it.
2013 draft class guy, my first draft I ever covered as a wee intern at Slam Magazine. One of the first guys who was like locked in his spot. Like he was going 3 to the Wizards. I remember that to this day. And it was like one of those early pearls of wisdom to learn how to figure out the job and report on the league. Because when you have that one building block in a draft full of mystery, it starts to lower the chances that you can get other things wrong. So shout out Otto Porter. And shout out to his team that drafted him, the Washington Wizards, for supplying the Dallas Mavericks with arguably the perfect center for Luka Doncic. Because, look, after going 2-5 out of the All-Star break with a messy defense.
Hang on, Jake. What are we doing right now? What specifically, like, bracketing the name of what we're doing? What is this called?
I was getting there.
All right.
We are vibe checking the Dallas Mavericks.
Cue the music.
Yeah, the defense was bad. The vibes were bad. Local radio started to implore the Dallas Mavericks to fire Jason Kidd, specifically for Mike Budenholzer, who is going to be the hottest name on the coaching carousel this summer. They got blown off the floor by the Pacers, which led Brad Townsend of the Dallas Morning News to report on a players-only meeting that was particularly spurred by Markieff Morris, which last night here in Miami, I was talking to someone about all the twins in the NBA because I am a twin. I'll just say it was Amin El-Hassan. He has twins. So we're talking about NBA twins and we were marveling at how many twins are actually playing in the league right now. And we were naming them all. And I was like, the Morris twins are still in the league. And he had forgotten. So shout out Amin. Shout out for the Morris twins' longevity. And Luka had a quote about the fact that Keith is helping him and he's a voice in the locker room. And now they're 4-0 since then. Daniel Gafford can't miss. He's rivaling Wilt Chamberlain, which is stuff that only Joel Embiid has really done, along with Nikola Jokic and one Victor Wembanyama in the last little stretch here. So I don't know. After the early returns were pretty poor. And people such as myself were criticizing a first-round pick and then some for Daniel Gafford and a top-two protected pick for PJ Washington that was, I mean, if this was top-two protected, I think it's just quite obvious that it was very nearly unprotected, which was a little bit skittish of a draft compensation to me. Sure. But they're turning the corner. Or are they?
Yeah, so I wrote about the Dallas Mavericks, should be the story maybe up by the time you hear this on Yahoo Sports. And here is my conclusion on the Dallas Mavericks from having spent a few days watching and reading about and studying and researching the Dallas Mavericks. I don't know what the fuck to make of the Dallas Mavericks. it's all fits and starts. It's a winning streak here, a losing skid here, a winning streak there. You know, win 3 out of 4, lose 2 out of 3. And like they've been this in and out, up and down team all season. The more relevant version of that is what they've done since the trade deadline, as you mentioned, bringing in Daniel Gafford, bringing in PJ Washington. And they'd won a couple of games before the deadline, won their first 5 after the deadline, then lost 5 of 6, and now won 4 straight. The 4 straight wins, they beat up on the Bulls. They took care of business on Wednesday night against a Warriors team that was without Stephen Curry and Draymond Green, which is basically like drawing dead offensively. and you know they beat the Heat. They blew out the Pistons. So it's like not exactly world beating play during the stretch. But you need to get right, and so they got right. They've sort of stabilized. Now 10 games over 500, which I think they've only done that maybe once or twice so far this season. They're in eighth in the West, like only a half game out of sixth, and I think a game and a half out of fifth. So it's like still tightly bunched there. And they will have stretches where you're like, they will score on anybody with Luka Doncic and Kyrie Irving, and the pieces fit a little more neatly together. You know, like, it's not that PJ Washington can be your stretch four, but like, if you already bend the defense, then you kick to him in the corner. He's beating a closeout and getting into the rim. Or when they get up, they get going in transition, they get up tempo, he's running the floor and filling the lane, and like another lob threat there. You mentioned Gafford has not missed a shot in five games. In that span, or I think in six or seven games, Derek Lively is something like 36 of 43 too. Like, their centers just don't miss shots anymore because they're getting like absolute spoon-fed service from Luka, from Kyrie. And so on offense, the pieces all really fit. The issue is, as always, is the defensive end. And so you look at that winning streak, the seven-game winning streak, they were giving up like 105 points per 100 possessions in that. They lose five out of six, it's like 125. They win four straight, it's like 106, 107. So like, as they defend, so goes the team. And the question is always going to be, what can they do against really good competition? Because they've been a team that has beaten up on bad teams all season long. And there's no shame in that. Like, you need to win those games to be able to put yourself in position to compete later in the season. But I believe the record is, I've got it here, one second. It's
17-23 against teams 500 or better.
Thank you very much. 17-23 against teams 500 or better. And we're like 7-12 against top 10 offenses. So that's who you're going to deal with either in the play-in race, or if you're able to get out of the play-in and into a 1-2 kind of matchup against Denver, against Oklahoma City, maybe not a weakened Timberwolves team. Although if the Wolves wind up in 1 or 2, that means they've had a hell of a close to the season, even without Karl-Anthony Towns. And that's, I think that's sort of what, it's a little bit of a bummer right now. They were shaping up to go into a couple of measuring stick games here. They got Oklahoma City on the road tonight. Now that was going to be second night of a back-to-back anyway, but national game, Oklahoma City. This is a way for the Mavericks to be able to say, like, here's who we are going to be. Here's what, like, the way we, now that we've got our guys all healthy, our starting lineup, like our 32nd starting lineup of the season, we think this is the right one. We've got the mix here together. Here's how we stack up against a really good team. And then late in the fourth, or midway through the fourth rather, against the Warriors, Luka pulls up after throwing a lob, hamstrings tight, goes to the bench, out of the game. There, it's unsure, uncertain. Maybe by the time this comes out, we'll know if he's going to play in Oklahoma City. But as of this morning, TBD. And then also leaves him unclear if he's going to be available for the Sunday game against Jokic and the Nuggets. So like, you maybe don't get to see exactly what this team looks like at full strength against those top teams in the West. But so all of which is to say, if you told me they were taking down a favorite in a first round series because Luka and Kyrie were going nuts, I would totally believe you. And if you told me they got beaten five because they couldn't stop a nosebleed, I believe that too.
Yeah, I think, weirdly, they are better positioned to win. If we're going full vibes,
sure,
they are better positioned to win a play-in game than they are a playoff series, in that those variables of Kyrie and Luka going off can be far more explosive and effective in 48 minutes than 48 and 48 and 48 and 48, right, when you're getting scouted and every single tendency is being put under the microscope. And you can guarantee, I can guarantee you, that any team that faces Dallas in a playoff environment, in a play-in push TM or a real series, that they're going to be keying in on this dynamic lob threat situation that they've got going right now. Because it's also been the goddamn story of Dallas since the second Derek Lively strapped up his sneakers and looked better than Victor Wembanyama in the opening night of the season. And look, this is not to like on Derek Lively. I just think Daniel Gafford's success in this role is more reflective to me of just how necessary that archetype has been for Luka to fully turn into what he has become this season, which is the best version of himself and arguably his greatest MVP campaign that he's put out so far without the team record to boost that. But it's been, I mean, the 30-point triple-double streak and what have you, like, it seems very clear that if there's one thing in addition to just getting Kyrie Irving and sticking the greatest possible scoring talent that he's ever had next to him and trying to mimic what happened with Kyrie and LeBron in Cleveland, like, they have found this piece, which didn't seem that difficult to find, but they now have found two of them in guys who can be real above the rim threats. Daniel Gafford doesn't look like a 7-1 string bean like Derek Lively, because he's not, but he's got super long arms. He can catch pretty much anything. His radius around the rim is like Michael Thomas's peak in New Orleans. That's another Joe Garza reference. And when I remember the Wizards traded him, people around that situation were like, oh man, like, we got rid of Gaff, like, bummer. Like, we kind of scooped him off the bottom of the barrel when he came from Chicago and we turned him into something. And I remember when they gave him that deal, a lot of people around the league thought that it was a bit of an overpay, but the numbers have been like, he's always been a super advanced analytics darling of just high efficiency numbers. Most of his stuff just comes around the rim and he dunks everything ferociously. So the marriage seems to make a ton of sense. I want to give a little love to PJ Washington, being that based off my reporting, he was someone specifically that Luka wanted to play with, and Dallas went out and got him, and it seems like he's finding his jumper a little bit more. Also, a ferocious big dunker when he gets in the paint, and he can be another person who can kind of cosplay as that rim running lob threat. He could rob at the rim. Why not? He could snatch someone's soul.
That's it. What's been most interesting to me about that is, so again, vibes perspective, right? One of the things that has made the Mavericks so difficult to peg, I think, is that you're trying to figure out who plays best with who. And given the resource management, you know, like, not just the, you know, the draft picks out or whatever, but also just like players in different specific positions. You've got four bigs now that you've got to find time for and minutes for, with Gafford and Lively and PJ Washington and Maxi Kleber. And the most comfortable Washington has looked has been like next to Kleber, where they go small and he is able to play like off of a floor spacing big, even though Maxi hasn't really been shooting the ball. But like, that has been like a look that has been pretty natural seeming fit, and then a good defensive alignment for Dallas. But doing that means you don't have either of the bigs that you spent significant draft capital to get on the floor. And so then there's the questions of like, and can that combination work if Kleber's not hitting shots? Are you getting the best versions of sort of either end of it? Like, I think there's questions about how well Dallas can defend against drop coverage with their traditional bigs in there. Like, they want to have those guys dropping back to the rim. We don't know exactly how well Gafford or Lively would handle a team that has a pull-up shooting, center or either pull-up shooting guards or catch and shoot, like pick and pop threat fives. And you would want Kleber and PJ Washington maybe more to be more switchable and mobile on the perimeter there. But you're also then not getting the guy that, as you said, you absolutely need to have with Luka or Kyrie, that like pick and roll dive, pick and roll dive, pick and roll dive, the vertical spacer sucking in the help, all that kind of stuff. So you're trying to figure out how to, you know, make the best of both worlds. And there's a similar kind of thing going on the wing with them, where Dante Exum has been a really great sort of reclamation project find for them, somebody who connects the floor really well, another complimentary playmaker. I know you spoke to him recently, right?
Yeah, but let's not tease that too soon. We don't know when the article is going to be dropping, man.
All right, sorry. We can even go back. I saw you putting the finger up like you wanted the lob. That's why I went to you.
Oh, yeah. No, don't cut it out.
All right, no, you can leave that in.
I was like, I was just going like a ding, ding, ding.
Oh, okay, fair enough. I thought you were like, put it up. I got something.
I'm Daniel Gafford, Luca. Give me the ball, baby.
I'm only Luca like when he comes back off of having a little bit too much fun in the summer. That's what I look like most of the time. there's Exum kind of feels like he provides some of the point of attack defense that makes him a good fit next to Luca and Kyrie. He can be a complimentary playmaker there. Like, you can scale him up or down in terms of usage and minutes. Derek Jones Jr. is a guy where he basically needs nothing and is the kind of point of attack defender on bigger wings that they don't have anymore after losing Dorian Finney-Smith and Reggie Bullock. Like, there's all these guys who kind of need minutes. And then is that like, that's coming from Josh Green, who has been they considered an important part of the ecosystem there, but sometimes he looks really good. Sometimes he looks a little uncomfortable. The athleticism plays, but the shooting doesn't. We also haven't mentioned in this entire conversation Tim Hardaway Jr., who halfway through the season looked like a sixth man of the year candidate. And now is like last night against the Warriors, he was the 10th guy for them. Like, coming off they got to everybody before him because he has been in a hellacious slump and doesn't offer you what you need on defense. So
waving off Kyrie just so Brandon Podziemski could come strip his cookies. That was definitely a tough one.
Wasn't good. Didn't look great. So all that to say, this is a lot of things for Jason Kidd to solve. And you mentioned up at the top, like, there are people who have looked at when the Mavericks look bad, it instantly flashes into your memory. Oh, right. The Bucks had all this talent and length and everything, and then looked bad with him. And then as soon as he left and they brought in Bud, everything made sense. What if we could do that here? But then, they're like 10 games over 500 and it looks good for stretches too. So much of it is going to be like Monday morning quarterbacking about the rotations that the kid chooses or whatever. But I don't know. I think they are in a really interesting spot right now, because if they go on a long run, and that's like two in 3 years under Kidd, it probably puts him in a much stronger position. But if they flame out early, and you went from like missing the playoffs entirely last season to flaming out early, and you're like, I wonder how it feels like a pretty precarious position for him to be in.
Yeah. Last thing before we get out of here on this subject and then get to an ad break, not out of the podcast in general. Although if you're listening, I'm sure you see the bar on the bottom that says there's still probably 40-ish minutes left. That's just a guess off the top of my head. Kidd is definitely one of the names that is starting to percolate on the coaching rumor mill. But he's just one of many that the ramifications of this postseason are going to impact many, many people around the league, particularly personnel, staffing decisions. And it's just something to keep an eye on because, that Budenholzer ghost is out of the bottle. The genie is out. And he could become a grant of wishes in many different situations. But Dallas is definitely one of the spots. And this is not, sources. Jason Kidd is on the hot seat.
Sure,
but
of course.
When people in the coaching community are canvassing the league and looking at potential openings, that is absolutely one people keep circling and highlighting. And the last thing on the Tim Hardaway Jr. point, when I asked Buddy Hield, I don't think I said this last week, when I asked Buddy Hield about his thoughts on how shooters who get paid pretty traditionally the last 5-6 years have just pretty immediately been thrust into the trade block like a used car. Like, the second you sign that deal, value plummets, people are trying to trade you. And I said, like Tim Hardaway Jr., like Duncan Robinson. And I was like, but then it fluctuates. Like, then you're not on the trade block and blah, blah, blah. And he just looked at me and he was like, well, I'm consistent. Which was really, really, really awesome. So shout out Buddy Hield. And shout out everyone who will stick around after we pay some bills and come right back. Welcome back to this episode of No Cap Room, being recorded from my... No, I'm just kidding. I want to give some love. We try to give a lot of love on the show to people who get overlooked in this never-ending conversation that is the NBA discourse. And to do that, we have taken the leaders of the Most Improved Player Award Watch, and we're just going to kind of bounce around some names, give out some flowers. And
before we do that, Jake, I just want to get, I want to set the table a little bit, like define our terms here. Because we've had conversations. I don't remember if it was on the show or off the show about, like, I have had an official year-end awards ballot for several years. And so I have voted on Most Improved Player. I don't know for sure if I'm going to be getting a ballot this year or what I'll be voting for, but that is one that I have. And I think you don't like the way I vote for this award.
Correct. Correct.
In years past, like, so here's the last 4 years I've had a ballot. I voted for Luka in 2019-20, Julius Randle in 2021.
Wrong.
Ja Morant in 21-22, and wrong. SGA last season.
Horrible.
So you, and then in the half season awards that is not a real thing, but I did it for the website in January, I had Tyrese Halliburton.
Terrible.
And so
the,
you, right.
The Randle one was fine. The Randle one was fine.
Explain why I'm terrible. Let's clip that out and save that, by the way. That feels like something I should bring up in actual therapy. Explain why I'm terrible. Go for it.
I understand why someone would want to... I'm trying to come up with a joke before I give the actual thing, but that's not coming to my head. I understand why someone would want to live in Los Angeles. I understand why someone would want to award... the fact that it is ostensibly harder to go from good to great than it is to go from bad to good. I get that. I get that. I also vehemently disagree that that should be awarded over someone who basically went from, like, not necessarily even having an NBA future to carving out a legitimate role that's going to get them paid for the next decade. Because to me, that is a bigger accomplishment when, like, your back is against the wall. You were either, like, a lottery pick who busted, or someone who had no real path forward to, like, generational riches that this league can provide you, as opposed to someone who's, like, already been tapped and given every opportunity by their team on a day-to-day cultural, developmental, whatever level. And just like, oh, because you've been already anointed as one of the next guys, you just happened to get there because of all the resources and attention you got. I think it's far more impressive for someone who was, like, wandering in the wilderness to find water, as opposed to someone who was, like, being led to water and then taught how to fish, and then they caught the biggest fish in the thing.
I think that is... I no notes on the analogies there.
Bang.
All good things. That is a completely valid way of viewing the award. It's something that I'm thinking about a lot as we're going to get into award season.
Uh-huh.
Like, do I feel comfortable changing the way that I do it? Do I feel like that's, you know, re-examine your rules is a good sort of way to think about things. So I'm thinking about that.
That's a nice therapized thought as well.
Well, I do this show. With that said, where do you want to start in terms of the discussion of, like, most improved player candidates this season?
I mean, also, as I have traveled a little bit of late, and, like, people in my personal life are saying, hey, who do you think should win these awards? Like, the obvious thing also is that, like, the dominant narrative does end up winning out. And right now it's been Tyrese Maxey's award to lose pretty much the second he had a very good game in, like, I think it was opening night. Like, I think he just started out the gate in the middle of all the James. Look, if James Harden was, will he, won't he be a member of Philly until the deadline, like Ben Simmons, and Tyrese was doing that, I would have had even more of, like, I would have had less of a resistance. And this is not like Tyrese Maxey is fucking awesome. And, like, he made himself an all-star this year after, I mean, he was the sixth man in Philly basically all of last season. The numbers, though, like, aren't that different from what he was doing when Harden was out and when he was a starter in the past. So, like, to me, it's just, did he improve or did his role improve? Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean he's not, like, deserving of the attention for capitalizing when that door opened and he was let inside of it, for sure. I would much rather, though, the other people that we're going to give some attention to get more attention and more acclaim, being that most of them probably aren't going to be in the perennial all-star conversation like Tyrese Maxey is, a la Desmond Bane should have gotten it in Memphis over John Morant, because John Morant, when he's not doing whatever he's doing off the floor and being injured for the whole season, he's going to be a perennial MVP candidate. So that's just where I stand.
I think what I just heard there is sources, Jake Fisher, not real Philly guy. Like that's what I think I just heard come out of your mouth.
I'm a Brooklyn boy now. I'm a Brooklyn boy now. You like my dad tweet from the weekend?
We can do this if you want. Yeah, you said you set a trap for me. I'm not sure I understand that. So walk me through it.
I just was at my favorite store. It's called Mother of Junk. Look it up. And it is definitely a store that has junk, that has treasures. And where's the line? I like to live in the liminal space. I like to explore the boundaries of that across everything, across most improved and MVP, across vintage and thrift. And I tweeted that out, and Dan responded, and there was no trap. I just was making a funny joke back to you.
Jake is trying to tweet like me, everybody. And I think, well, if there's one thing that we can establish, it's that no one should be trying to tweet like me. Not because you can't reach at the hem of my garment, but because save yourselves, get out while you still can. Yeah. All right. So Maxi is a little too close for your taste to the kind of...
Yeah, we can move this along.
Yeah, and like the kind of guy that maybe shouldn't quite fit into that definition.
Yeah. I think someone such as Kobe White, who, knock on, this is not wood, this desk here, had a pretty scary fall last night after Pascal Siakam had an awesome block to stave off elimination, but this is not a reality competition show, to force an extra period. I mean, Kobe was number 7 pick, supposed to be a guy, wasn't. The Bulls go out and they sign Lonzo Ball. And then I forget exactly the years, but I remember he had a shoulder injury that it was either after his first year or after his second year that I remember talking to a buddy of mine on that Bulls staff who said, like, man, that just took all the wind out of like my and Kobe's sails about his development. Because like 4 months in the offseason, that's when you get better. Like, right. That's when you actually fine tune the tools and sharpen the knives, and then you get out there and you put it to work. So the fact that, I mean, I forget exactly when it was, but there was some time late January before the deadline where when I checked out my Bulls and was trying to like squint and see what the Bulls front office was seeing, Kobe White looked like a future multi-time all-star. And he has at multiple times this year. He has this like powerfulness to his speed when he does his change of direction, and especially right to left through the legs. He has this power with a first step that I don't think too many guards have. And it is like honestly breathtaking to watch how his fro is flowing in the wind behind it, and he just gets past pretty much anyone at will. And if that continues with all the Lonzo question marks, like Kobe White is arguably the reason why Chicago didn't do anything at the deadline, didn't blow it up, because sure, like DeMar is moving up the all-time scoring list night after night. Nick Vucevic can still get you 20 and 10 in his sleep. And you've got little pieces here and there, the Alex Caruso's of the world, although they don't grow on trees. That closing lineup that they were using last night with Torrey Craig as the fourth man, like I understand why Chicago would think like, yeah, this is a true play-in team and like might as well. But none of like Kobe White just absolutely raised the floor. That was the dyslexic moment right there. Of all of that, from now and the future, regardless of what happens, the fact that you have this dude doing this right now on a 3-year, $33 million extension that he signed before this season, all of a sudden he looks like he has one of the best contracts, best value deals in the entire league.
And so much of it is about opportunity, right? You know, you mentioned that he was expected to kind of step into a larger role right away when he got there as a mid-lottery pick. Doesn't get there right away, winds up playing behind like Thomas Satoransky and Chris Dunn in that like jumbled up backcourt, gets buried behind Lonzo Ball as he comes in and DeMar as he comes in and Zach LaVine's emergence. Like he has to kind of fight out from underneath. Zach LaVine gets hurt in the November, and it's basically been the Kobe White show ever since. You know, even during the brief period where Zach LaVine came back, like Kobe White wasn't stopping. This has been a consistent, legitimate, rise for him out of this fringy spot. Since that first LaVine injury, he's at Kobe White. So that's whatever that is, 50 or so games or however many games since late November. Kobe White averaging 22 points, 5.5 rebounds, just under 6 assists a game, 59% true shooting, about 24% usage. This is all-star stuff. As you're saying, the stat that kind of blew my mind. So you look at those numbers, 22, 5, and 5, or not even that, 25 and 5, shooting that accurate for the course of the full season. Only 10 dudes are doing that. And it's all like all NBA ballot, MVP ballot, like Jokic, SGA, Giannis, Luka, Domas Sabonis, Kevin Durant, Embiid, LeBron, Donovan Mitchell, Zion Williamson. Now, obviously, they're clearing those numbers at different levels than Kobe White is, but 25 and 5 on above league average true shooting is star. That is the quality of offensive player, like all around production that every team is searching for. And for the Bulls to find it kind of between the couch cushions with something they already had 4 years into his career, like that can be transformational. Whether it will be for a franchise that very frequently seems to be running in place, and, you know, Arturis Karnisovas at the trade deadline when they didn't really do anything was like, we're just looking to be competitive. Under the Jerry Reinsdorf regime is basically like just get into a postseason game, get some gate receipts and then like that's kind of about it. So if you aspire to something greater than that, you're going to need to see some more commitment, especially if this is the end of the DeMar DeRozan, Lonzo Ball kind of era there, which may well be. We certainly hope that DeMar, we hope that Lonzo Ball. Last I saw, he could actually get to sprinting again. That would be great. It would be wonderful to see Lonzo Ball back on the floor again in Chicago or elsewhere. But whatever the next iteration of the Bulls is or is going to be, Kobe White needs to be a gigantic part of it because he certainly earned that with his play this season.
So as of March 6th, these were the leaders of the MIP betting odds. It was Maxi, White, our sweet Alpi Sengun, who we talked about and wrote about last week.
Get well soon, big fella.
Get well soon, yeah. What an awesome season for him. Jalen Williams, who you talked about and wrote about at length. Awesome season for him. Mm-hmm. Jonathan Kuminga, who was my preseason MIP pick back at Yahoo Sports.
Looks really good.
Jalen Johnson, who I can report is scheduled to come back the day after we record this Friday.
Dun, dun, dun.
We'll have more to talk about him in a second. But Dan, just quickly, as time is falling out of our hourglass, what are some other candidates that you just want to run through and give some shine? Do not say Tyrese Halliburton. Do not say Jalen Brunson.
Okay. Well, I'll have you know, I didn't put Halliburton on the rundown here. That was super producer John Gennaro. And my note on it was my pick at midseason, which Jake fucking flamed. kind of to your point about what sort of improvement we should be considering for this kind of award and opening the door to different sorts of players. It made me think about just like guys that have made a leap in one area or another this season. How about Herb Jones? We've talked about him. I talked about him with Shamit on Divine Intervention a couple weeks ago when I was talking about the Pelicans. We've talked about him here. The general idea of like a guy who had made 123 three-pointers through two seasons has already made 91 this season, improved his percentage by 10 full points. He's like seventh. Herb Jones is seventh in the NBA in three-point percentage this season. And that's crazy and fundamentally changes who he can be for the Pelicans and maybe who the Pelicans can be overall. So maybe that's like a discrete specific skill that you look at and say, well, that's not like the overall total game, or that guy was already a starter in the NBA, so this doesn't necessarily move the needle that much. But that's a kind of improvement. Him, and then a very similar guy in that vein, Jalen Suggs, was like a 21% three-point shooter when he came in, shooting up near 40% on volume this season, makes him an integral part of that Magic core in a way he wasn't before. Is that the kind of improvement that you're kind of thinking about?
Yeah, for sure. And like Duncan Robinson, shout out to the Miami Heat. I mean, the fact this is going to be bigger than this year. The fact that that dude was left for dead,
absolutely,
came back in the playoffs and went inferno on several occasions. And then now, looking at and assessing why he fell out of the rotation behind Max Strus a year ago, when his shot wasn't falling and he wasn't really reliable to do anything else. Now he's doubled his drives per game, and it's a legitimate function of Miami's offense and not just something he breaks out when the shot clock is running down and things are broke. Like, he is no longer just the Wayne Ellington mold of flying off screens to do movement shooting stuff to like distract the defense and create other stuff. Like, he's a James Harden system unto himself. No, I'm not going that far with it. But when you become that type of player, like J.J. Redick was with the Clippers, and then throughout the rest of his career after that, and they're both fellow podcasters, so maybe that's part of it too. when you add another element of your game that is a direct counter to your other strength, it boosts both of them, I think, more so than just like, oh yeah, now I can work in the post now a little bit. Like, it just really unlocks a whole nother dimension to what he can do and therefore what Miami can do. Although obviously four straight losses, as we talked about at the top, they still have some things to figure out.
Yeah, it's funny because you're right to note, like, Max Strus kind of like came in and market corrected him to some degree. It was like, you know, I can do that, what that guy does, maybe not like as accurately all the time, but I can do more things. And so that banished Duncan Robinson to the depths of the fringes of the rotation. So he kind of made himself Max Strus. Like, I am now going to be able to take those handoffs and turn it up and go to the rim, finish 70% there. Like, oh, but I'm six, like a legit 6'8 or 6'7. I have the size to get, you know, if I can get tight enough with my handle to get in there, I can make something happen. Max Strus was always better at making that extra pass. Like, he wasn't a great, you know, you wouldn't run your offense through Max Strus, but comes off those curls, those handoffs from Bam or Jimmy, he could make the next pass. Duncan Robinson's averaging like 4.5 assists per 36 minutes this season. So yeah, these are at a time in your career where guys don't always add those extra skills. They just sort of continue like refine what they've been, what got them paid. You know, you brought him up as an example of a guy, you know, it's like he gets the contract for shooting and then winds up out of favor. He made himself back into a player of consequence for a team that wants to be something bigger. So I think that level of improvement, that's a little bit more to me like, it's not Julius Randle, because Julius Randle made himself an all-star and an all-NBA player a few years ago. But guys you don't normally get that much better at discrete things or multiple things 7 years into your career, right?
Yeah.
So Robinson in that vein is somebody that I thought made some sense there. I know you said I can't say Jalen Brunson, so I'm not going to say Jalen Brunson.
Yeah, we got to keep it moving.
But if we're being in New York, maybe Dante DiVincenzo. Like, again, that's a lot of it goes back to the three-point shot. But scaling your volume up while remaining that accurate and also multiple positions defense. Like, he's always been good at a bunch of different stuff. But he is averaging, he's shooting 40% from three on 15 three-point attempts per 100 possessions. That's insane. Like, it's completely ridiculous. That's insane. That is a level of accuracy and volume that the only two players ever who've done that for a full season are Steph and Clay.
And now Dante last year.
Yeah, right, exactly. And Dante DiVincenzo is doing that while defending across the perimeter. So, like, you can say maybe that's a good function of role. Like, they just need him to shoot constantly to open things up on the inside for their bigs, for Brunson, for Randle, et cetera. You can say it doesn't necessarily mean he's a better player overall. But that's one where, again, I'm like, I can look at you and say, that is a skill that you didn't used to have. that you have developed and honed in a fashion where like it is now a gigantic weapon that makes you a different player. So again, maybe the kind of guy that we're thinking about here.
Yeah, we have to shift into our last segment, but one last shout out to Denny Avdia, who every single NBA team was interested in trading for at the deadline after he was not someone like that a year before. So shout out Denny. No one's watching the Wizards, but he's doing great stuff there. No one's been watching the Hawks so much either, as they continue to be just kind of average. But if you haven't seen Jalen Johnson this year when he's been healthy, the dude, I don't know what his ceiling is going to be, but the dude at his peaks this year is giving kind of scary flashes of Blake Griffin with the Clippers and Ben Simmons in Philly before, obviously, Ben fell off.
I was going to say, I think I might need to make the noise from like, to,
yeah. But before that, three-time All-Star, multi-time All-Defensive nod, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And like when the trade winds started and DeJounte Murray's name was out there, and it was like, oh, actually, Atlanta was willing to trade everyone but Trae Young and Jalen Johnson. Mm-hmm. And his path from being someone who went to Duke as the next guy, right? He was the top recruit in a, you know, starry-ish freshman class. He was supposed to be the next Tatum, the next Brandon Ingram, who went to Durham, led the Blue Devils to the big dance, and was a top 10 pick and would continue on his merry way. That was what Duke told his family and their recruiting pitch and whatnot. And there was a ton of stuff that happens during the draft, the pre-draft time, where rumors are flying left and right. People are dragging players' names through the mud. You've got lies, bold-faced lies being brought up about, it happens every year. There was a nasty, nasty rumor about someone having Marfan syndrome in the last couple of seasons that proved to be completely false. And it's just this game where teams are jockeying for positioning, hoping certain players fall, and agents are withholding information, trying to get their guys in certain situations. And it was, like, to this day, if you mention Jalen Johnson's name to a certain scout or so, they will say, oh, well, there's all this stuff. You know, at Duke, he was uncoachable and didn't listen and didn't have a motor and blah, blah, blah. When I flew down to Atlanta and I sat down with this kid, and I've spoken to people from his high school coach to his G League coach when he first got to Atlanta, someone at Duke, his parents, the whole village that has raised this kid into someone who's now averaging 15, 8, and 3.5, you know, approaching 4 assists a game. The three-point shot was up at 40% in the beginning of the year on a pretty large sample size before it declined a lot. I mean, the kid has done everything he can to reverse every false narrative about him in the draft. He is grinding at Hawks practices. When I was there, after practice, he's always getting work in at the same basket with Quinn Snyder, kind of hover. And Quinn is looking at this dude like a ball of putty that he can stretch out and roll up and put in different situations at all times. He is definitely someone that Quinn Snyder is fully, fully bullish on, will be able to take a leap kind of similar to like Kobe White, I think, next year in his fourth year. Like, can he be a real all-star candidate, especially with all the questions about who's actually going to be in Atlanta next year?
Well, yeah, I think that's fascinating to me, because the question that has sort of loomed over the Hawks for the last handful of years is, how do you build around Trae Young? What do you need? And there was that initial idea of, you put a rim, you know, pick and roll, dive man center,
and rim
and like big wings around him.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they drafted Jalen Johnson, I'm thinking like, oh, that's like the next attempt to get, you know, like, we're going to make the DeAndre Hunter pick right. You know, we're going to get another guy like that that's more consistent, that's able to stay healthy, whatever. And the things that he was showing, or he had been showing over the course of the season, it's like, there's more there. Like that guy can do more. He can scale up his usage. He can be more creative. And he's an absolute record defensively with his size too. So the question that I think now, as all you, and I'm sure you're hearing a ton of it, the rumblings about like, is Trae Young really all that untradeable, you know, like off the market now? It feels a little bit more now like, are the Hawks looking at it and saying, that's actually the guy that we build around? Like, it's not how do you build the team around Trae Young. It's you've got the big wing who can do everything. What kind of team do you put around him? Maybe that's a premature thing to say, but given what he's put on film this year and what, as you mentioned, the statistical markers, it might not be that far away.
I don't think it's premature. I think as the story that's going to come out today, ideally before you listen to this, is going to illustrate, I think he is the surest bet to be a foundational member of this roster at the start of next season, based off the age, based off the upside, based off of the fact that he recognizes the fact that he needs to come every day and get better. The story starts off with he didn't go to a beach or a little all-inclusive resort for All-Star break. He called his trainer, Clutch's trainer, Chris Johnson, and he flew to LA and did 3-day workouts during the All-Star break. The guy knows that you have to get better incrementally, day by day, and that the results will come, which I think is super rare for 22-year-olds in this instant gratification era where guys are getting paid off of potential alone. And that's part of why all the pre-draft intel that was out there about him does get considered. It's that teams do have to evaluate the person behind the player, honestly, almost even more than what the skill set is, because when you hand a 21, 22-year-old $100 million, how are they going to respond? Are they going to be happy and content? Or are they going to say, oh, well, if I do X, Y, and Z from here, I can make $300 million. And that's a different type. It's not just even that. It's like, oh, do you want to win? Do you want, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
So the fact that that was the exact opposite narrative about him, and he has completely flipped it on his head. He has taken that and used it as a strength. He has figured out how to be consistent day after day. And he's going to LeBron at their shared workouts with Clutch and Chris Johnson and asking for tips and tricks. And LeBron is saying that you're an all defensive caliber player if you set your mind to it. And he's got guys like Kyle Korver who's now part of the Hawks brain trust, helping him continue to iron out that jump shot. And Quinn is putting him in all these types of positions on both sides of the pick and roll as a screener and a ball handler. He's encouraging him not just to rebound and push, which that is, if you really want to see what this dude is fully capable, that is where he shines the most, when he has the ball on the open floor, full head of steam. I mean, the guy he's unleashing poster dunks. Very few people in the league have that power and that grace and that speed. So if this is sounding hyperbolic, check out the tape, man. I'm not saying he's going to be a perennial MVP candidate. I'm not even saying that I'm stamping this dude as a bona fide franchise player moving forward. But he's someone who is absolutely outperforming his draft positioning. And he could be, just like all the other guys at the top are talking about, he could be changing the course of Atlanta's decision-making and trajectory, honestly, more than anybody, if he does end up emerging as that one pillar this summer that is truly untouchable.
And that's exactly right. Like, the thing that's so cool about a story like that is it's easy to get locked into just one way of thinking about a team. Like, the Hawks are just, all right, it's a bummer, it's underperforming, the whatever your stock kind of bullet points are. The Trae Young, DeJounte Murray partnership hasn't been working the way they wanted to. They got to blow it up. They got to do whatever. So finding something new there to get excited about, a reason to believe in whatever the next iteration is going to be, and like a good, legitimate growth story in the course of all that, that's something you can hang on to. That's something you can look forward to. It's something you can believe in. And I think Jalen Johnson looks like that kind of player. He's got the opportunity to be that kind of player. and something that, you know, as the Hawks wend their way to through the play-in tournament, another appearance there, and they're going to be in the probably the 10 seed and seeing if they can fight their way up from underneath there. Jalen Johnson, certainly a player to keep an eye on as they do that.
Last thing on Jalen, a quote that I did not get to make it into the story, because Landry Fields sat him down and helped him understand that it was going to be a time to develop. Remember, he got drafted in 2021 after the Hawks made the Eastern Conference Finals with John Collins and DeAndre Hunter and all those young wings that you were talking about. It was clear he was going to have to take some time. Jalen said this, quote, "Landry just told me, be ready to take a little longer. As far as culture, everybody knew it was going to be a work in progress, and I wanted to put in the work. And so that's how I used that first year. Every day I'm putting in some type of work. I'm getting better somehow, some way. That's not going to be anything that's going to pad stats. But if there's one thing I can control, it's how much work I put in, how hard I work, even if I'm not playing. I'm still going to do something. I'm not going to use that as a time to be like, I'm in the NBA. I'm going to sit on the bench and clap and just not get better. I'm going to get something out of the day. That's where my mindset has been and will be, especially since that first year." He was really thoughtful, man. There's a lot of quotes in there that I definitely implore people to read. Talk to his parents, talk to plenty of folks around the situation. And he's just someone I'm really rooting for. He really is. So that is all we have for you today. Thank you to super producer John Gennaro, who does all the things to make this show look and sound great. And thanks to Dan Devine. Thanks, man. I appreciate it. Yeah.
Shouts out to Dan. Absolutely.
And also you, Jake.
Shouts out to you.
Subscribe to Ball Don't Lie on YouTube or whatever podcast platform you are currently listening on, and leave us a 5-star review. We thank you. We appreciate it. We came back again next week for another episode of No Cap Room.